Tweet at TodaySOR.
Well, just going back to our conversation earlier about poverty and child poverty, we got an email which I do want to read to you. It says, "Dear Miriam, I'm a single parent. I've lived in consistent poverty for 16 years. I have one child. I've worked on and off over the years, but due to cost of childcare, etc., I didn't stay in the jobs and I've been on social welfare for the majority of the time. I've had to seek the help of the Vincent de Paul on numerous occasions. I wouldn't have survived without their support. There have been times I haven't had heat, very little food. I've no social life. There is no money for treats for either myself or my daughter. It's been really difficult, a constant struggle, and it's a lonely struggle because it's difficult to say to people that there is no money and that you're living in poverty. I hope you read this out, Miriam, but please don't read my name." We'd lots of emails and text as well from people. A nice one in from a granny of five, four children under four. "Aren't those people in Cork and elsewhere wonderful to children?" She's referring back there, of course, I think, to Brendan Dempsey in the VDP. "The company's so generous and caring, we don't hear much about it. I would buy and shop in those stores after hearing about them." Aideen says, "It's a diabolical disgrace that the government sees fit to give 68 million to dog and horse racing while people go hungry." Well, now I'm joined in studio by our gathering. Welcome, Ruth Coppinger, Socialist Party TD for Dublin West. Fiach Kelly, political correspondent of the Irish Times. Michael McNamara, who's walking in the door, Labour TD for Clare. And Alison O'Connor, columnist with the Irish Examiner. Good morning to you all.
Morning. Morning.
Listen, Fiach, we'll have to start with our interview at the very top of the show, and because it was your story in today's Irish Times. Sean Barrett, Alan Shatter.
Yes, I heard the interview, and the Kian Corlaer was disputing various facts, and he said that certain letters were impersonal letters. But I think the story as outlined in the Irish Times this morning was very fair to the Kian Corlaer. It reflected the exchange of correspondence at first from Gallagher Shatter, which would be Alan Shatter's legal company, as representatives of him, referring to our client and the difficulties our client would have. The issue at the centre of this is Alan Shatter is taking a High Court action against Sean Gearan. He's the barrister who was tasked by the government with investigating the claims made by Maurice McCabe. The government accepted those recommendations. On foot of that, we have a commission of investigation. Alan Shatter said, "Hang on, Sean Gearan wasn't fair to me. He acted too quickly. He didn't interview me as he interviewed Maurice McCabe." So he's challenging Gearan in the High Courts. And then he's also saying, well, if the government is going to accept a commission of investigation, then because I'm challenging Gearan in the High Court, it should take the aspects to do with me out of the commission investigation as before at all. So this week we had the opposition walk out with the letter from Alan Shatter's office, from Alan Shatter himself. It's signed Alan Shatter TD. It has Alan Shatter's picture on the top of it. It says, "I am sorry again to communicate with you about this matter. I do, however, regard it as a matter of great seriousness that is not only relevant to the circumstances in which I find myself, but is relevant to how public administration is conducted in this state, the independence of the courts not being encroached upon by either house of the Oireachtas, the concept of the separation of powers embraced within our constitution, and the importance of preserving the rule of law." So there was letters from Alan Shatter to Kian Corlaer this week, and on foot of that we have this now row which seems to be escalating between the Kian Corlaer and the opposition.
But you heard him, and I suppose what Sean Barrett is saying is that there was no bad intention here. He was merely doing what he had to do because there were legal letters there.
Absolutely not. And no one is ascribing any bad intention to Sean Barrett. In fact, if you read the pieces outlined today and you look at the correspondence, Sean Barrett actually let the motion through as it originally proposed. And he didn't change it as Alan Shatter wanted. The only thing he did was, based on his legal advice, he said there's going to be no debate on this, because if there is a debate, then we could be encroaching on the separation of powers and things could be said in the Dáil, which would jeopardise what's happening now in the High Court. So no one is suggesting that there was any... Sean Barrett acted inappropriately or anything like that, but there were letters that went, and it should be noted that Sean Barrett let the motion through, although without debate.
Yeah, but why at the last minute? Because there was time set aside... You know, deputies had indicated to speak on the topic. It was very last minute that it was pulled. And the key question is this. Like, Sean Barrett, the Kian Corlaer, came on your radio programme. That's great. He hasn't had to even answer to the Dáil as to why this debate ended. He hasn't had to show his legal advice, which now turns out to be a letter from another Fine Gael TD.
To be fair to him, there's legal advice in the House of the Oireachtas as well, to be fair to Sean Barrett.
He hasn't showed to the Dáil. Did he get advice from the Attorney General, for example? This was asked yesterday. We haven't seen it. I indicated to speak in the order of business yesterday, and this is the only place it comes up in the order of business.
But Ruth, he actually said also this morning on the phone that, you know, the debate, he hadn't stopped the debate of substance. It was more to do with, you know, the rules of evidence and stuff. It wasn't about the substance.
Well, the time was pulled. There was a few hours set aside for Thursday. I think it was Wednesday and Thursday. Yeah. And that is pulled. And these are important topics. We all know that one of the biggest issues last year for this government was the whole issue of their connection between the Gardaí, you know, oversight of the Gardaí and their connections with this government.
Let me bring Michael McNamara in there, because I quoted Alan Kelly earlier, you know, the Labour deputy leader, saying he was concerned that he was talking about a constitutional crisis. What do you think after hearing this morning?
I mean, I don't think it quite reaches the threshold of a constitutional crisis, but it is an issue. I mean, the Dáil should be able to debate, in my view, as much as I think it's in the public interest that the Dáil debate issues of the day openly and freely, and people answer questions in the Dáil, and obviously they don't always, and that's a huge problem. On the other issue Ruth raised is whether he received the Attorney General's advice. I mean, I'm not certain, but I don't think it would even be appropriate for the Attorney General to advise, because the Attorney General advises the government. Sean Barrett isn't the government, he's the referee, effectively. He's the Speaker of the House. But it raises a broader issue, and that's legal advice generally. I mean, you know, backbench TDs from both sides, from opposition and government, are often told, well, the Attorney General's advice is blah. And they're not in a position to challenge that in any way. They're not in a position to get their own advice. There's nowhere where they can get legal advice. And, you know, there's an inherent inequality of arms that you're told this is the Attorney General's advice, the government has to follow that, end of story, end of debate. And that's a huge problem. Now, it was a problem in many parliaments, but I do know that in the Commons, for example, they've moved towards remedying that and saying, well, where the government does come out and say it's the Attorney General's advice, to sort of share that advice more openly, and also to allow where people disagree with that advice to get alternative advice. On the issue of... but on the specific issue, I mean, I might not agree with Sean Barrett. He kicked me out of the Dáil once. I don't always agree with Sean Barrett. But at the end of the day, there has to be a referee. And he's not accountable to the Dáil. But of course, he can be removed by the Dáil.
For me, there's a wider issue here surrounding the role of Ceann Comhairle. And listening to your interview with him this morning, there was a phrase kept going around in my head, Ceann Comhairle's on the verge of a nervous breakdown, which of course he isn't. But I think part of his problem is that the Ceann Comhairle sounds a lot of the time like he's under a lot of stress. And it reminds me of, I have small children at home, and listening to him dealing with the TDs in the Dáil, it reminds me a lot of that, where you realise pretty quickly if your children are not going to walk all over you, you must show very little vulnerability. You must attempt at all times not to raise your voice, to let them know that they've gotten under your skin. Right. You know, that they have, that they're really good at doing that. And the issue for me is that Sean Barrett, and who unfortunately for him has quite a high-pitched voice, is sounding very stressed all the time.
But I asked
with
him
the people in the Dáil chamber. No, but just to finish that point,
pressure, I suppose,
so that
I,
he
the
does.
Opposition.
But I think he does. Just as a matter of human nature, he doesn't help himself. But I am trying to remember a previous Ceann Comhairle during my time observing Irish politics, who is engaged so much with the media, who feels the need to come out and defend himself, who's obviously getting into difficulty in the chamber with Sinn Féin, with Fianna Fáil. And I think that there is almost a bit of an air of hysteria going on now. And I think that Fianna Fáil and Sinn Féin are sensing blood. They're sensing that vulnerability there. And I worry about where it's going to end up.
The Ceann Comhairle posed himself as a bit of a victim. He came out on your thing this morning. He butts in. Yesterday, for example, I spoke in the Magdalene Laundries, and halfway through my speech, he butted in and told me to get back on topic. I was on the topic of the power of the church and over health and education. You know, so he is political. And he's also butted in, for example, last week when I was starting my leader's questions with a snide comment. So I resent that one man, I think it's wrong, has the power to pull a debate on the Gardaí in this country and on an investigation in this country without any accountability.
Because he's not here, Ruth. He might say he feels increasingly under pressure, as Alison's saying, in recent months and weeks. He obviously does feel that people are out to get him. So maybe that makes him more likely to snap or say, go back to topic.
Well, that's his own decision. It's like Alison said, I was a teacher. There's certain rules you just don't do when he creates a worse situation. But we don't personalise this because it can sound like...
I think what Alison said is probably correct, in that the opposition parties, Sinn Féin and Fianna Fáil, probably sense that Sean Barrett is under pressure. But it must be said that he was used last year in a way that hadn't been seen before, before in a long time, by Sinn Féin. And he came out over Christmas. He said he felt that they were using him as a pawn. It must be remembered that at the height of the difficulties around Maria Cahill, the following day, Mary Lou MacDonald staged a sit-in in the chamber, brought the place to an absolute standstill.
And then
he was put up as this victim, and you had Gerry Adams making speech. Yeah. So I can understand why he's under pressure.
No, I wouldn't disagree with you, and I wouldn't like to be in his position, you know, and I think that generally he's a fine politician, but my case would be is that he doesn't help his own case.
That's true.
I'd agree with Alice to the extent that he's probably in the media more than other Count Cordis have been, but I mean, there's more of a concerted media campaign against Sean Barrett than there has been against any other Count Cordis that I can remember.
But I have to say, the media do not have to go scrambling for material on Sean Barrett.
No, but when I say media, when I say media, I mean particularly social media, like Facebook, Twitter, etc. There's a lot of stuff circulating, and it is unprecedented that parties in the Dáil would seek to undermine a Ceann Comhairle, who, and ultimately there is going to have to be a referee, and you know, who wants to be the next Ceann Comhairle if they are going to be politicised and undermined in that manner? So one other thing, he did say he obtained legal advice. I mean, it's a general issue for any office holder, whether it's a Ceann Comhairle, a minister or a county councillor.
Yeah.
When they receive legal advice on a particular issue, how can they possibly, you know...
They normally have to show it. I was on a council for 11 years, and I have to say there's a bit more accountability and interaction on the council than there is in the Dáil.
I would like to see legal advice shared more broadly.
Yeah. And the idea, I know you were splitting hairs a little bit there. My point was, if the government, for example, really wants a debate, why don't they come out? Or are they just using the Ceann Comhairle like they use the HSE and, you know, the NTA and keep themselves at a remove from a distance?
He's got fights with everybody. He's some sort of a lapdog for the government. He's anything but. I mean, he's had a number of rows
very,
with Fine Gael and Labour.
He usually does veer in on the side of the government in any debate.
Just before we leave the point, on the substantive issue, the story you wrote this morning, Fiach, is it still going to keep going? The fact that, I suppose, the letters were there, the debate wasn't held, whatever, you know, the Ceann Comhairle says. Do you think that's a story that will keep running or not?
I think it's going to keep going by virtue of the fact that he came on your radio show and actually did what he did. And I think he said some things that he felt people were out to get him, maybe.
I mean, the further thing in terms of giving fodder, I mean, the interview he gave recently to the Irish Times, where he seemed to indicate that he might stand down as Ceann Comhairle, and, you know, and then the office of the Ceann Comhairle issues a statement saying...
I thought it was you, Fiach, and the reason I asked, because there was all these rumours going around Leinster House that because he may retire to next election, he may step down and allow Fine Gael put a different TD into benefit from the free run. And I just said
and
to
his
him,
answer seemed fairly clear.
His answer seemed to say, look, I've yet to make a decision, but I don't want to leave this house as the Ceann Comhairle. I want to go back onto the back benches and have my say before I go. So he raised the possibility, and then
Then you have his office having to clarify. That's more of what you could describe as not helpful. Can I just make one further remark on the personal letter issue, which he really took umbrage with? Am I right in thinking that Alan Shatter, as Fiach said earlier, was sent from his solicitor, if you like, and one was signed by Alan Shatter himself, but that it was sent then to the office of the Ceann Comhairle? So it's fair enough for Sean Barrett to say, Alan Shatter may say, I sent a personal letter, but Sean Barrett would say it was sent to the office of the Ceann Comhairle.
But it's still a personal letter from Alan Shatter.
If my editor sends
me a letter saying, Fiach, your work is terrible, it's a business letter personally sent to
never
me.
Happen,
it never happened, Fiach. Okay, let's move on. Obviously, our president, Michael D. Higgins, subjected this week to certain behaviour by water protesters. Ruth Coventry, do you think our president is a legitimate target for those protesting against water charges?
I wouldn't use the words legitimate target. That could be misconstrued. First of all, can I just say that Paul Murphy has been very badly and wrongly misrepresented in two headlines in the newspaper. He was asked his view on a protest that we'd no hand act or part in.
He was also interviewed in the radio, though, and gave his own point of view.
I was specifically referring to two front page headlines, you know. We support people's right to protest. The president is actually, in my view, a political figure. But can I just explain, he wouldn't be my focus. My focus would be bills are coming out in April. We have to persuade people not to pay them in order to get rid of the water charges.
But do you think what happened to him was wrong?
No, I think personal insults are absolutely wrong. There's no place for that kind of thing. People should stick with politics. I've taken people to task over sexism, over all sorts of things. Can I just explain, I think, why people, I was talking just about this in advance, people had illusions that the president was going to stop that bill. I was actually quite surprised over Christmas on social media, the number of, you know, ordinary people who thought that Michael D. Higgins was, you know, making statements against austerity. He does make political speeches. He made one only this week. And that he would in some way prevent the bill from being signed. Now, they were mistaken, but those illusions built up and people were genuinely disappointed. And if you consider that the water charges was one of the biggest issues, brought more people onto the streets in a generation.
I think it was ridiculous to think that the president wouldn't sign the bill. Again, it comes down to the advice that he operates within, the advice that he gets. I also think that indeed Michael D. Higgins has made a number of speeches about austerity and how it has affected people. So you could therefore say that he is a friend of people who have suffered, which makes it all the more ridiculous. And if you look at his political history, I think that our newest TD Murphy needs to cop himself on, basically.
What did he say, yeah. Alison? Yeah. No, well, can you actually, because your newspaper put two headlines which were completely erroneous. He never condoned insults.
To what happened to Joan Burton and Talla. There is a certain tone that Paul Murphy strikes, which to me is not a tone that should be struck by somebody who's democratically elected as a TD in our parliament. And I think it suits him, and I think it is extraordinarily populist of him, and I think that he, one of these days, he'll be hoisted by his own petard.
Well, Michael, I'll let you then. Michael McNamara.
I was particularly, Paul Murphy's a lawyer. He studied law in UCD, and much was made of that when he was elected. He seemed to suggest that the decision on whether or not to sign a bill was a political act, and the president could have decided to delay the bill or convene the Council of State. That's untrue.
It's not.
It's a constitutional act. The only time that the president can convene the Council of State or refer a bill to the Supreme Court is if he believes that it's unconstitutional. Now, as far as I can see, it's open to Ruth to say it's entirely unfair to have water charges or that it's wrong or that it's immoral, but there's nothing whatsoever unconstitutional about it.
Okay,
and the president has to sign a bill. We have a democracy. People debate. The representatives of the people debate an issue in Parliament and they pass a bill, and it is signed by the President unless it contravenes the Constitution. So for Michael D to do anything other than either sign the bill or refer it to the Supreme Court if he thought it was unconstitutional, would be unconstitutional. He's not the King of Denmark. He can't refuse to sign a bill because he doesn't
because he hasn't been in fear.
I think that Michael is right, that there is a fundamental misreading of the President's role in this. It was not a constitutional issue. It was an issue on water charges. The President can't really...
It's
deliberate misreading. He can't... Yeah. It's not even that he gave the impression. I remember the day he signed the bill that there was this kind of protest sprung up outside the gates of the RS. The people were protesting that he shouldn't have done this. It was slightly bonkers, and people are perhaps misleading certain people in the protest group, saying that Michael D should have done this. But Michael D himself, possibly, I do take one of Ruud's points that his statements against austerity in the last 3 or 4 years have been very political. He arguably has crossed his line and the government has let him away with it. So perhaps he let the impression linger out there that he was against austerity. But in saying that, what happened this week, or last week as it was, is a furthering of this coarsening of public debate, which we've seen in recent times.
Tactically, I think the idea of protesting at the president is mistaken. Right, I think it's not really where the anti-water charges movement should be. But Paul was asked specifically his attitude, did people have the right to protest? There are actually, most people out there aren't sitting looking at the Constitution, in fairness, and at the powers of the president. They did, a lot of people voted for Michael D. Higgins, and I'm assuming the illusion came from, he would in the past have been left-wing, etc. There are actually two powers. You can refuse to sign a bill under Article 14 and there's a commission that moves in. I'm not advocating it. I'm just correcting the idea that people wouldn't know.
But look, we're going to move on. I'll tell you why. Because you say most people aren't reading the Constitution. Michael McNamara, your party is in government, to be honest. What they care about this week is, can I buy a house?
Yeah.
Is that 20% cap? Is it fair? Because Patrick Honan is talking about the average house price in Dublin, but we were talking about it last night in primetime. It's incredibly low for most people. It's going to be an awful lot of money for people to try and buy a house, to get that deposit of 20%?
It is, but firstly, the central bank operates independently. But secondly, the last government and the last central bank was criticised for allowing people, effectively people borrowed money that they couldn't afford to borrow.
Or
they borrowed
that.
Money that they couldn't afford to pay back.
And now, the banks lent it and they shouldn't.
The banks lent it and they shouldn't. And then there was a big question, well, why weren't the banks regulated properly? And now the central bank is moving to regulate the banks to make sure
but
that
is it
they
fair?
Can't. Is it fair that people can't borrow money that they couldn't hope to pay
is
back?
Is it fair yes. that people can't buy houses?
Well, one of the reasons people can't buy houses is because money is being thrown out by banks to people who can't afford to pay
no,
it back.
It's now, because you're not actually wrong. Building any, Michael. That's the problem.
The other side, the other thing, if I could, Ruth, I don't think I've interrupted you so much,
sorry.
But
well, no,
the government has brought in a housing
point.
Plan to build 35,000 housing units by 2020 and 18,000 of those by 2017. So there's an unprecedented housing development plan by this government and by Alan Kelly in government.
Awesome. Do you think it was fair?
I think that it's, I so struggle to say it's fair when I'm someone who lives in a house which I like to say myself, my husband owned, like we have a mortgage on it. So you're looking at it from the other side of the fence. But I think we have such an attitude in Ireland that sort of, you know, about the housing market and buying, make me pure, but just not yet, you know, so that we haven't, we still have that attitude. We still have the obsession with property, I believe. And an awful lot of it for me, I think, comes to this culture change, even in terms of the rental market, giving more rights to tenants, trying to get Irish people to change in some small way their attitude to property and to ownership, which remarkably has remained stuck despite, you know, what we went through over the last 7 years.
There's no rent caps here. It's a different world. If you live in Germany,
it's not even caps. It's even just the sort of buildings that we build, the rights of tenants, you know, being thrown out. Yeah. You know,
if
all
you
of
if you live in Dublin now, if you live in Dublin now and you're not a homeowner, you're kind of caught between the devil and the deep blue sea. Because I do accept what Alison's saying, that there has to be a sea change away from the obsession with property. But Patrick Holland this week said that, according to his figures, that I think half or under of homes being bought by first-time buyers in Dublin were under the €220,000 cap. I'd like to see where he's talking about. Like, where are they? But the thing is now, if you're trying to save for a deposit in Dublin, you have this 220 limit, then 20 anything over that. But you're likely to be paying rents that are going through the roof. So you're stuck. And I just think it is unfair to people living in Dublin. And possibly, I don't know, Michael, would there be some sort of policy initiative to kind of take the sweetness
off that? It's not going to work anyway, because there's a lot of reasons why house prices go up. 40% of house purchases now are by cash. They're by people who have quite a lot of money. So that's going to propel the prices up. The other problem is, as what was said, we need rent controls, because that's pushing house prices up because of the buy-to-let sector. We also need to stop the crackdown on repossessions, because that's then, you know, adding to the whole, you know, frenzy. And by the way, only 59% of people in a survey today in Dublin own their own homes. So the idea that we're wedded to this thing of people are stuck in the rental market in Dublin and we need more houses to be built, and the government strategy isn't going to work.
OK, I want to discuss Aer Lingus just before we close. Pascal Donoghue on last night, the minister. I got nowhere actually trying to say the political considerations are going to rule the day here. Mm. Are they, Michael McNamara? Let's be frank, you're a Clare TD. Mm. They do.
No idea whether or not they're going to rule. But I'm very clear about where I stand on the issue.
Yeah.
And I mean, there are a number of Labour TDs in Dublin equally who are concerned at the sale. I mean, in Dublin, it's an issue of connectivity, but primarily potential for job losses. I mean, my big concern is that Heathrow connectivity is key to the business development and the development of jobs in the Midwest. We had an announcement of 100 jobs in Shannon the week before last, and the company that went in there, Amex, and the minister who announced it, Jed Nash, were both key to stress the connectivity.
The key really is your dull seat.
No, the key is connectivity. I used, before I became a TD, I actually worked in Afghanistan and I used to fly into Shannon through Heathrow. And the fact that Heathrow was connected to a hub was key. Now, that's one thing for me, but for business people in the region, like whether or not I'm a TD, and I won't be a TD for the rest of my life, I hope, or else it'll be a very short life. but
I will continue. TDs are admitting to you that they're going to be bowing out.
I didn't say I'm bowing out, but I certainly think the life in politics.
One by one,
I can't think of a more dreadful way to spend your whole life.
I want to get a quick response.
One thing, I mean, it is key to the Midwest that we retain connectivity to
home. What do you think? Should we sell it or not?
I think there are so many complications here. I heard somebody referring to Aer Lingus as the family airline this week, and I thought that was very accurate. I wonder how long is Willie Walsh out of Ireland in terms of making a bid now in the run-up to a general election campaign.
The most valuable seats we're talking about now are not the seats in a plane, they're the seats in Dáil Éireann, and I think that's the big consideration that's going to be. As someone in government said to me this week, this is a year one issue. It isn't a year five issue in the lifetime of government. It's probably not going to happen.
Yeah. Ruth?
Yeah, just really quickly, a lot of people in my constituency also work in the airport and rely on the airport. I was totally opposed to the privatisation in the first place.
You're opposed to it. But can I just say one thing? What about international research and evidence that says Aer Lingus is too small and the way the airline industry is going internationally, it simply won't survive?
I think that's rubbish. I really do. I think it's Aer Lingus is making a profit. You know, it's made, I think it was 160 million last year.
It's small.
And we have Heathrow slots.
Won't be writing general election manifestos.
Yeah, no, this is true.
To respond to something Alison said, the bid was timed to coincide with a point in time when Aer Lingus doesn't have a CEO. And that is far more key, I think, to what will happen in this decision, because Fianna Fáil effectively privatised Aer Lingus. 75% is gone. Aer Lingus doesn't have a CEO to make a decision on the bid. The government 25% is, to a certain extent, incidental to what the shareholders of Aer Lingus will decide.
Final quick point, Vic.
I just think that it's probably unlikely to happen. And I think Willie Walsh, actually, I thought would have been outselling it more himself. We haven't seen much of Willie Walsh since he launched
this thing.
We've
all been asking for him.
Exactly, but we haven't seen him. Someone saw him on the train at the town the other day, but that's the nearest sighting I've seen of Willie Walsh.
Should have grabbed him. Okay, well, look, my thanks today to Ruth, to Fiat, to Alison, to Michael McNamara, to all of you for listening.